Okay, we're starting now.
Blog Talk Radio.
Denise Griffiths is your partner in success. Tune in each Friday as virtual assistants, industry expert, web developer, and online entrepreneur Denise Griffiths interviews industry experts from one end of the internet to the other. These expert entrepreneurs freely share their business building knowledge and provide practical guidance that will show you how to build and grow your own very successful business, be it online or traditional brick and mortar. Now, ladies and gentlemen, your partner in success, Denise Griffiths.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to today's show. Today, I am absolutely delighted to welcome to the show one of my very favorite authors, Larry Wingate. Larry is a 5-time New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestselling author, and his titles are provoking, thought-provoking, and just flat-out fun. Some of them are You're Broke Because You Want to Be, Shut Up, Stop Whining, and Get a Life. Another one is called Work for a Reason, Your Success is Your Own Damn Fault, The Idiot Factor, and we'll be talking today about, well, all of these books, really. But we're also going to be talking about his most recent bestseller, Your Kids Are Your Own Fault. So Larry is somebody you probably see on TV a good bit. He regularly appears on Fox News and Fox Business, CNBC, MSNBC, is a financial expert, and I see him regularly on Neil Cavuto show. In fact, he has just too many other television programs and appearances to mention here, without losing valuable time chatting. So I am going to send you to LarryWingate.com. You can find him on Amazon. You can find him on Wikipedia. Larry Wingate, LarryWingate. You can't throw a stick on the internet without stumbling across him. So Larry is known as the pit bull of personal development, and he is. And he joins me today to discuss how he uses social media, why his website looks so very different from everybody else's, why his customers love it, and why some of his fellow authors kind of don't love it. And we're going to talk about just about everything else we feel like covering today. So I invite you to join us in the chat room if you have questions to ask Larry, or you know, just drop in and say hi. So Larry, good morning, welcome, and thank you.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's great to chat with you. You have a great, great story. As I was telling you earlier, my husband and I started watching you on your show, The Big Spender, and it actually did make, we made some changes in our financial life because of that show, and we'll chat about that a little bit later. But you have a really interesting background, and if you can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself before I launch into the dozens of questions, you know, that I have for you? I have a ton.
Do you really? Well, you know, I'm not sure the story is all that interesting. I'm sort of a regular guy. I grew up kind of dirt poor in Muskogee, Oklahoma. My epiphany in life was at the age of 13, walked into my 8th grade class and had a kid look up at me and said, "Wingate, are you so poor you only have one pair of jeans?" And that was true. But he caught me and I was busted because my pair of jeans had a rip in the pocket, and it was obvious it was the same pair every day, and I was just humiliated, embarrassed, and all that stuff you can be at 13 years old in front of a bunch of little girls. And I made a decision in my life at that moment I was going to be rich. Didn't know how I was going to get rich, didn't have a clue what rich even looked like, because that was certainly not what I was surrounded with. But I just decided at that moment I'd do whatever it took the rest of my life to figure out how to be rich, and I did. My key to success is I just worked harder than everybody else. No matter what I was doing, I could work longer, harder, smarter. I could do more investigation, more research. I could put my ego aside. I could get on the phone. I could ask anybody anything. I would do whatever it took. And that sort of became my claim to fame. No matter what I was hired to do, nobody worked harder than I did. Maybe they were better at it, but they didn't work any harder at it. So I went to work for the phone company. Was one of the first male telephone operators in the country. Then I worked my way up from telephone operator to area sales manager with the state of Kansas for AT&T. When divestiture happened, left, started my own company. Did real well at that. Went to work one day, a rich guy. Went home that day, a broke guy, and lost everything because it was ruled that what I did wasn't going to be allowed anymore by the Corporation Commission. I didn't get grandfathered in, so my business went away in a day's time. So again, grew up broke, got rich, went bankrupt, and then went from bankrupt to multimillionaire again because I worked harder than everybody else. I decided to become a sales trainer. I had done sales training for AT&T and written a lot of it, and went into the speaking business as a sales trainer. Didn't take me long to find out that people thought I was funny, and then I found out they pay you a whole lot more to make people laugh than to do to make them smart. So I went with that, and for a few years I was a business humorist, got sick of that, got sick of everything in my life, had midlife crisis, decided I hated everyone and everything that came out of my mouth, left, went into the mountains, had my journey of dealing with who I was, figured out who I was, and what I figured out was I'm willing to tell the truth no matter what people think about it. Went back on stage, got heckled, screamed at a guy to shut up, stop whining, and get a life. Audience loved it. I wrote a book, became number one bestseller, and here I am today. How's that for the short version of who Larry Winget is?
I love it. I mean, that was very succinct. You know your stuff, apparently.
I've told that story before.
I thought maybe you had. Actually, I wasn't aware of some of it, and I thought I knew a good bit about you, but I didn't know that you had lost your business in one day, so that's interesting.
Yeah, it's actually the best thing that ever happened to me. Everybody goes, oh, what a sad thing. Shoot. If that hadn't happened to me, you and I wouldn't be talking right now. I had to be tough. I had created a lifestyle I was not willing to sacrifice. So while I lost everything, and I mean literally everything, we lost it all, I had to figure out once again how to be creative and do whatever it took. That's a lesson people need to know right now. I don't care how much money you got or how much money you've lost during a time of recession, what are you doing about it? I mean, we've all got sad stories. I think that's one of the reasons I was so good as host of a personal finance show is that people tell me their sad stories, and I don't care how sad it was, I'd been broker than they had. And I'd been willing to do more than they were willing to do to fix my situation. And that's really the key. It doesn't matter how stupid you've been or how many mistakes you've made. Are you willing to do whatever it takes to fix it? And I always was and still am. I mean, I'll do what it takes. I'm not too good to work. That's the problem we have right now is a lot of people, because of a sense of entitlement, just think that they're too good to do whatever it takes. And that's the place you have to get to in order to really turn your life around.
Well, I don't even know if we should go down this road, but I keep seeing all these extensions of unemployment. And I have to tell you, my teeth snap together every time. And
listen, if we cut it from 99 weeks to 6 weeks, it would be amazing how many people could find jobs in 6 weeks instead of 99 weeks. The statistics say, and we don't have to go down this road, you're right, statistics say people don't even look for a job until they're about 3 weeks away from unemployment running out.
Right.
And so when you got 99 weeks, I guess the way you look at that is I got 96 weeks, I can sit on my butt, collect my $400 a month, and I don't have to work.
Mm-hmm. Don't have
and
to
if
do
we
that.
Would cut that out, people would figure out a way to work. People would figure out they have to do something. They'd go to their garage, take the crap that's laying around, and build something. They would do something to make a living. And I think that the part of our American entrepreneurism and our creativity has all been lost because people are sitting on their fat butts on the dole when they used to have to work and get creative and think of what they had to do to make a living.
Absolutely. I can agree with you more. I mean, you just really clearly, succinctly put my thoughts into words. So let's talk about some of your books, because your titles are pithy. I mean, they are straight to the point. I mean, they're great.
Well, there's a reason
actually,
for that.
I have, on another topic, I have to tell you, when you had your show, you would how did you say it? Your success is your own damn. How did you put
something? Oh, when I opened the show, the opening every week? Yeah, the final line of the opening every week is, I would say, it's your own damn fault. And it is. It's your own damn fault. But I am known for the titles. And believe me, if when I look at the success of the books, and I'm very fortunate that I've had two number one bestsellers. All five have been on New York Times or Wall Street Journal bestseller list. And I think that I can attribute at least 50% of the fact that people buy the books to the title alone. Statistically, most people don't read books anyway, but they like the titles and they see the titles. And so I work harder on the title than I do on the whole book. Titles are important.
Well, it's so funny because that phrase got stuck in my head, and I told my husband when I told him I was getting ready to interview, he said, "Oh, you're going to ask him to be your ringtone, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, I am," because I love that phrase.
We have those greeting cards online you can send around to people.
I said, all I want is for my phone to ring and have Denise, you know, your voice say, Denise Griffith says, it's your own damn fault. That's all I want in life. But anyway, I had to get that out of my system. So let's go talk about your books, because your titles are great. So start where you want to start.
Well, let's start with the first book. The first book I wrote was based on that little speech I mentioned to you a few minutes ago. It's called Shut Up, Stop Whining, and Get a Life. That's the best title I've ever written. It's not the best book I've ever written. I mean, it was my first one, and it was fine, and it was solid, and it still probably outsells everything else, but it's just such a good title, because I think there's so many people out there that just want to say that to other folks, and they certainly need to hear that. In fact, that book is being turned into a comic book by a new publisher, which will be out in the fall, called Shut Up, Stop Whining, and Get a Life, and the comic book. And it's got me as this superhero and cowboy shirts and boots and stuff. It's really a fun book. I just have finished giving the final approval on it. But the Shut Up, Stop Whining, and Get a Life is sort of a three-part book. If you're going to change your life, number one, you need to shut up. Stop talking, start listening. And then you need to stop whining. We've got a society right now of whiners. It's never their fault. We love to blame everything and everyone for our situation. And when you're whining about your problem, you only prolong the problem and make it bigger instead of making it smaller. So stop whining about things. Third part of the book is Get a Life. And I show you how to create the kind of life that you want. After Shut Up, and that book, I had never sold a book, was not interested in selling a book. I'd written 20 self-published books at that point. And a buddy of mine said, yeah, Larry, but your self-published books never get in bookstores, which I didn't care because I speak to 500,000 people a year face-to-face, so that was a good enough bookstore for me. But I guess my ego got in the way, and I said, sure, okay, I'll sell somebody this book. So I sold it to sort of a small publisher at the time. Put it out there, and I had a pretty good fan base. And the first week it was out there, it went to number one on the bestseller list. So it was a good thing that I did that.
Right. Well, speaking of your comic book, I was watching a thread on Facebook between you and Jim Bouchard, and he asked about getting autographed copies. And I have to tell you, Christmas is coming, and my husband really needs this in his stocking. So where do I? I hope he's not listening. So where do I get an autographed copy of your comic book?
You know, as soon as the comic book is released and we get them in hand, which will be in mid to late November, we will have them on the website. They'll also be available from every bookstore and on Amazon, and all the other bookstores will be carrying it. But the autographed copies will all come from my office. So just people need to go to my website, sign up. They'll be notified, or they'll figure out how to find out when the book is out. They follow me on Facebook or any of those things.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So anyway, after Shut Up, Stop Whining, Get a Life, I released, went with a big publisher, because believe me, you write a number one bestseller out of nowhere, publishers come out of the woodwork and say, who are you? And
I bet.
Yeah, and so my next one went out with Penguin, and the title was It's Called Work for a Reason, which I just took. I'm sort of a one-trick pony in that I have one central philosophy, and that philosophy is life's your own damn fault. Take responsibility for it. And that taking responsibility, I drive through personal development. It's called Work for a Reason. I drive through business. So it's a business book that deals with every aspect of business, from selling to how to be a better manager, to how to be a better employee, customer service, all of that stuff. And the business book that hit the New York Times bestseller list as well. After that, I went with a personal finance book, which is sort of what I'd been defined for the last few years, and still am, as a personal finance guy, because of the A&E Big Spender Show and all the PBS specials and CNBC specials and the Fox News and Larry King and all that stuff, I'm defined as a personal finance guy. So I wrote a personal finance book called You Broke Because You Want to Be. Now, you talk about a provocative title, especially in a time of recession. The last thing people want to hear is that you're broke because you want to be. Everybody says, no, I'm not. Well, yes, you are, and you can argue with me all you want to. Bottom line is, you got yourself in this situation. It's up to you to get out of it. Nobody held a gun to your head and made you spend more money than you make. And, in fact, I was interviewed the other day on a show, and a guy said, how did you become one of the country's leading personal development gurus? I mean, personal finance gurus. And I said, you know, it kind of amazes me. Pretty much all I got is spend less money than you make, but since half the country doesn't do that, I've become a guru. And it's true. Half the country spends more money than they make. So So
does the country.
Yeah. So my personal finance book is not any how to invest and how to get rich. I don't care if anybody gets rich. It's not my problem if you get rich or don't get rich. Subtitle of the book is how to stop getting by and start getting ahead, which is the real goal of where people are. Most people just get by. So it's a very practical book about how to get control of your finances. And believe me, if your finances are out of control, that's just a symptom. Every other area of your life is probably out of control, too, at some level. So this is a book about how to get in control of your finances. Real simple, take responsibility. It's very tactical. Everything I do is very tactical. It's got lists that you fill out. Every book does. I ask you tough questions. I mean to offend. It's part of my goal in life to offend people and make them uncomfortable with where they are. That's why I don't believe in the motivational crap that most people do. I can't make you so happy with another place that you're willing to go there, but I can make you so uncomfortable with a place you are that you'll do anything to get away from that spot. That's my goal. I want to make you uncomfortable with where you are so you pick up your stuff and move on your own accord. I don't want to paint a pretty picture over here and say, wouldn't you like it better over here? It's not how it works. People move out of discomfort, not when they're comfortable. When people are comfortable, they sit there. When people are uncomfortable, that's when they get up and move. So my books make people uncomfortable. But they're also very tactical, and they give people a solid direction they can take.
Absolutely. You know, people who are in comfortable divorces or comfortable marriages may stay there, but if they're really miserable and they're uncomfortable, they're going to get a divorce. I look at finances the same way. I mean, if you're just so miserable, you're bouncing checks, your credit card company laughs at you, it's time to do something different.
Well, it really works in your relationships with your money. It works with your health and your weight. You know, as long as you can get up and look in the mirror and go, you know, I don't look too bad, you're never going to lose a pound. It's when you stumble in at 3 in the morning naked, flip on the bathroom light, you go, damn, I'm fat. That's the motivation that gets you to move and start doing something about it. So, you know, I'm sort of that harsh light at 3 in the morning that you flip on and make you sort of look in the mirror and go, whoa, I'm out of control here.
And
so I went from you're broke because you want to be to people are idiots and I can prove it, which I really like that book. It was renamed in paperback as The Idiot Factor. Because we found out that even though it also became a New York Times bestseller, that the title offends people. You can't just say people are idiots and I can prove it. They, you know, their timid sensibilities are too fragile to handle that.
Oh, no, that was my favorite title, hands down.
I thought so, too. And believe me, it's the easiest book I ever wrote. I mean, it's so easy to prove how stupid people are. Mainly on the simple premise that people say one thing and then do everything in their power through their actions to make sure the opposite happens. People say they want to be successful, and then they do everything in the world to make sure they're not successful, like not getting to work on time, like not giving 100% on the job, like not returning phone calls, like all those things. People say they want to be healthy and then do everything they can to make sure they're not healthy, like continue to smoke and not exercising and eating like a pig. People say they love their kids. That's the stupidest thing people ever ought to tell me, is to tell me how much you love your kids. And believe me, that offends people. And that's the reason I wrote the last book, because the average parent in America right now spends 3.5 minutes per week in meaningful conversation with their kids. So don't tell me how much you love your kid if you won't take more than 3 minutes to talk to your kid. That's the premise behind people are idiots, is that we talk a good game, we just don't deliver it. And all I do is take all the ways that we sabotage our lives, and that's the subtitle, the 10 ways we sabotage our lives, our business, and our money, and show people what they're doing wrong. You know, I don't think you can show people a better way till you show them the stupidity of the way they're living right now, and that's kind of what I do. And then I do always show them a better way and give them the worksheets they can fill out. Then the last book, the new one that came out in January, also hit the bestseller list, was Your Kids Are Your Own Fault.
Now, that one has got a great title as well. I'd love for you to go a little bit deeper into that one.
Well, you know, your kids are your own fault. That's also one of those titles that offends people, because they go, no, it's the school's fault, or it's the government's fault, or no, bottom line, it's your fault. And, again, that title offends, and people don't want to take responsibility, which is my central theme for every area of your life. They don't want to take responsibility for the way their kids turn out. And yet our kids are a disaster. I mean, they are a true disaster. Unless we get a grasp on that, our whole society is doomed. I've spent 20 years on stages all around the world. I've talked to 400 of the Fortune 500 companies. The last 4 or 5 years, I've made a focus on personal finance, dealing with couples and individuals about how to turn their money around. I deal with companies about what they need to do to be more successful and to sell more, deliver better service, and to be better leaders. And so I've spent all these years doing that, and I decided last year that's the biggest waste of time. I've wasted 20 years because you cannot make a company do better by giving them better tactics. You cannot get people to pay their bills on time if they don't understand the ethics and the morality and the honesty that goes behind all of those things. When I was a little boy, my dad, it was very simple, I never forgot it. He said, Larry, you can't get a good deal from a bad guy. And right now we're expecting to get a good deal from bad people. It goes through Congress. It goes through every business that's out there. We are expecting people to do the right thing when they simply don't understand what the right thing is. If your life is not grounded in ethics and honesty and doing the right thing, I can't stand in front of you and give you a list of tactics that you're going to follow long term because you don't get it. I mean, when people, and they used to, when I was doing Big Spender and I would attack people's integrity, they would say, no, Larry, this is about money. And I said, money is about integrity. And people didn't like that because I attack your integrity. If you don't pay your bills on time, you're a person who lacks integrity. You don't lack money, you lack integrity. Because a person who has integrity will pay their bills on time regardless of what they have to do to come up with the money. If they flat don't have the money, at least they'll call and communicate with people and say, this is what I do have. How do we make this work? They'll do the right, honorable thing. So that's why I decided last year, stop talking to businesses about just turning your company around and stop trying to get people to do the right thing with their money. Instead, let's turn the focus to what really matters, and that's creating the right kind of people. To do that, we have to be the right kind of parents. You know, the subtitle of that book, I always like my subtitles as much as I do the titles, is A Guide for Raising Responsible, Productive Adults. I fought with my publisher on that one. They said, it's really about raising kids. And I said, no, we don't raise kids. Nobody raises kids. We create adults. And so this is a book about how to create successful adults. I am not a parenting expert. I have become an expert over the years about what it takes to be a successful adult. So I ask parents in this book to design the perfect 35-year-old. What does a 35-year-old need to know to be successful, have good relationships, be financially responsible, and have some money in the bank, have a good, strong work ethic, all those things? What does that 35-year-old need to know? Identify those things, work backwards to make sure you're teaching your child that. And then in the book, I ask you to do some analysis about how you're doing, how often you're communicating, and what you're communicating. And I give the 5 most important things every parent ought to do and then what they ought to teach and those sort of things. So, again, it's a workbook on how to make sure you accomplish your plan for your child.
You know, I would suspect, just from listening to you, I haven't read this book yet, I just ordered it, but I would suspect that a lot of people can actually help themselves become a better person as well as a better parent, just by kind of, you know, going along with this and saying, well, I'm supposed to be teaching this to my child, but I may not know it myself. So maybe I better do some digging and become a better person before, you know, I ruin everything here.
Yeah, that's the real challenge right now is you should teach your children, and this is all pointed out in the book. It's like we tell our kids never to lie, and we do not want to raise little liars. And then the phone rings. And the little kid answers it. And the little kid says, Mommy, it's whoever. And the mommy whispers, tell him I'm not here.
Right.
So there's a big contradiction. Don't you ever lie to me. And then you just taught your child it's okay to lie. We tell our little kid not to cheat on their spelling test. Yet something like 35% of everyone cheats on their taxes. So we're not demonstrating good ethics and honesty and good communications. And so you're absolutely right. As you're going through the book saying, this is what I need to be teaching my kid, you will start to identify this is the book I need to start. I'm 35 years old, and I didn't learn this stuff, and I need to learn this so I can then transfer. You know, and I still hear this from parents, and I discuss this in the book, that so many people say to me, well, Larry, I tell my kids all the time, do as I say, not as I do. Dumbest thing any parent ever said. Dumbest thing any human being probably ever said is do as I say, not as I do. Your kids will always do exactly what you do, and they will rarely do what you say. They're going to follow your example. You've set the bar. And so if you're fat, stupid, lazy, never read a book, sit around on your butt every evening, do nothing but watch TV, don't be surprised when that's what your kid does. Become the person you want your kid to become.
Well, you know, one of the things that I heard you and Larry Jim Bouchard talking about on a previous show is the fact that there are so many kids these days, you know, they're working in low-level, you know, behind a counter. You know, they may be at McDonald's or, you know, they could be anywhere. But one thing that you said struck me, because this happens all the time, and I'm so mildly to moderately offended by it that I'm known to walk out of restaurants or stores, but... You know, what you said was that so many kids are not able to function with the most basic of manners. They can't look you in the eye. They don't say hello. They don't say goodbye. I mean, I have left grocery store lines because the checker can't even be bothered to look up and see if I'm human. I don't talk.
Yeah, I always interrupt them and say, excuse me, I am a customer. Remember, I pay your salary. That just...
Right.
That surprises them and usually offends them. And yet blame the employer, and yes, it is the employer's responsibility to make sure they deliver better service, but that's not an employment problem as much as it is a parenting problem. Mom and daddy should have taught them the basics of human interaction so they can actually speak to people. See, that was communicated clearly to me when I was a little boy. My dad would stand me outside of a restaurant or outside of a group we were going into, and he would say, Larry, this is what you do when you go in here. This is where you look everyone in the eye, you stick out your hand, you say, hello, my name is Larry Wingate, it's nice to meet you. You say ma'am and sir and please and thank you. You acknowledge everybody. That's how you behave in this situation. And if you don't, Larry, you know there will be consequences. Now, that was communicated to me before I entered the situation. So there was never, ever did I have to wonder how I was supposed to behave. Parents are not good at communicating in advance, one, what they expect, and two, what the consequences of not getting what they expect are.
Well, I know that I'm seeing a lot of this, and we're going to kind of wind around to Facebook and social media, because this same kind of ignorance, I'm just going to call it what it is ignorance, I see it on Facebook all of the time. You know, people will just kind of pop up on your page. You don't know who they are. They're trying to sell something, or they just make oddball comments. Social media is pretty much the same as face-to-face for me. What do you think about that? How does that all...
Well, believe me, I think Facebook is a reflection of our society, which pretty much tells me that the bulk of society is stupid, illiterate, can't type, can't spell, has no... courtesy, common decency, thinks nothing of spamming your page to sell their stuff, even though they don't know you and didn't ask permission. They step on your toes, in essence. I really think it's a reflection of where we are in our society. Remember about a year ago when you were able to sign up and you could become Facebook.com/Larry Wingate? And your name would become, that would be your URL. It'd be Facebook/Larry Wingate. So I got up the next morning, and I thought, it's no big deal. I'll get up in the morning, and you could do it at midnight, and I'll just get Larry Wingate. And I knew there was only one guy in the whole world that stood a chance of getting it, and I have a cousin that I met one time when I was 3 years old. His name was Larry Wingate, but he's not very active on Facebook, so I didn't think much about it. I get up the next morning, and they say it's already taken. I do a little search, and at 12:03, this guy, 23, 4 years old, he took my name. It wasn't his name. Yeah. He took my name. So he became Facebook.com/Larry Wingate. So I wrote him this email and said, why did you take my name? And he said, I thought this would probably bother you, but what I'd really like to do is set up a time for you to meet with me and discuss what I can do to be more successful. And I knew if I had something to barter with, that I would be in a more powerful position. So now I have your name, and I want some of your time. I said, well, one, this is blackmail. Two, stupid, if you'd read the rules, you can't give me my name back. You can never get out of this. I can't get Larry Winkett back on Facebook because you took it. And it says very clearly, once you take it, and that's your chosen username, you can't give it away. And believe me, for the last year I've tried, and you can't get it back. I'll never be Facebook.com/Larry Winkett because some bozo named Eric took it. I mean, I even did an article for the New York Times on this very thing, people abusing social media and taking identity theft through social media. And I was one of the examples they used. And I wrote about this, and I said, well, listen, you want some attention. That was the whole idea. You took my name so you could get attention. I'm about to give you some attention. I have 30,000 people on my easing list. I have, at that point, I had like, I don't know, 3,500 friends and another 4,000 or 5,000 fans on my fan page, and there were 3 or 4 other fan pages. I said, I can get you about 50,000 people that will show you some interest real quick. So I have your name, I have your telephone number, I have your real name, your real email address. I'm going to just blast everybody and give them your name and tell them what you did. And I did that. I let 50,000 people know that this guy had stolen my name and that he was trying to barter it back and blackmail it for some of my personal attention. And I said, please give him all the attention he wants. And trust me, my fans, they did that.
And the guy wound up on a prison list somewhere. You know, the pen pal.
The guy, I mean, he left Facebook. And then he wrote me later and said, I think I probably did a stupid thing. And I said, yeah, I think you probably did. But here's what, and that story doesn't even matter. I mean, he really couldn't hurt me all that much. I'm not that hard to find. People can spend 10 seconds and they'll find me on Facebook. It's not that big a deal. But here's what I found most alarming, is that after sending this out to 50,000 people, I got, I don't know, a couple of thousand people wrote me about it and responded to the New York Times article, and I wrote a big blog about it and so forth. And 25% of the people who wrote me back or responded to what I'd put out there on the Internet said that I was to blame, not him. I was just mad because he had outsmarted me. And what he should have done was blackmail me for money and forced payment, cash payment out of me, that he did exactly the right thing and was a smart entrepreneur for stealing my name. That's the sadness to me that goes along with all of it. That's why I write a parenting book. This is a kid who's going to college and trying to figure out how to be successful and yet did something that was not based in honesty and integrity and the truth. He stole somebody's identity for the sole purpose of pulling information from them. Now, that is dishonest. And yet, 25% of the people thought he was a smart person, and I was the stupid person. To me, when you steal something that's not yours, it doesn't matter what it is, and it doesn't matter how much it costs. I don't care if I take a piece of gum. If it's not mine, it's stolen. Or if I rob a bank, if it's not mine, it's stolen. Or if I take somebody's name and it's not mine, it's stolen. Anytime I take something that isn't mine, it's called being a thief. And yet we have a society that doesn't really think like that. That's why I think it's sad. And I think that's what happens when somebody on Facebook says, this is a product I have to sell. They become my friend or my fan, and then they use, I mean, they've got 200, and I've got 9,000, and what they decide to do is to spam my 9,000 by posting their crap, when I've never heard of them, on my page. And believe me, I attack pretty hard when people do that. In fact, I have people that attack for me, will report them to me if I miss them or don't catch them, because there's a lot of postings on my stuff I just don't always catch. Then, of course, we block them and report them. But it's a sad reflection of where we are right now in our society, most of what goes on Facebook and most of the social media stuff.
Well, and it's something you said earlier caught me, too. I'm a stickler for punctuation and spelling. I just am. That's the way I was taught. I can't stand to see poorly written messages or messages that, you know, a lot of what I'm seeing is people put you are instead of your, Y-O-U-R. They're using all these weird abbreviations. I can't stand them. It's just a personal thing. I don't like them.
Well, I don't either. But, you know, I posted recently that it's amazing how many people want to argue the logic of something that I say. And believe me, people love to argue with me, which which I have
no
problem.
I follow you on Facebook. I get involved in, I'll get involved in some of those 90 convert. You know, you'll post something, and, you know, an hour later, 90 people have responded. And when I
I posted recently that it's amazing how many people want to argue the logic of what I have to say, and yet can't spell. Use proper grammar or punctuation. And I know that sometimes they're limited to a certain amount of characters, but we're not tweeting here. This is Facebook. You can take the time. Besides that, am I the only one that my Facebook underlines in red that this word is misspelled?
There is spell check.
Exactly. I mean, when I don't spell something right, it tells me before I hit share. I don't get it. But I think that Facebook is a wonderful thing, and it's a wonderful way to keep in touch with people. And believe me, I am very much in touch. I get more feedback saying you're the most active person at your level that really talks to your followers and fans, and I do. And nobody else does that for me. I personally do that. One, because I get a kick out of it. Two, I think it makes me much more real, which is pretty much what all my books and things are about. Just be authentic, and I am authentic. And three, I guess it's because nobody else could say the obnoxious things I did, even if I paid them to do it.
Well, I could. So if you ever need help, let me know. But you're right. And I think one thing, and there are some very good things about Facebook, and one of them is exactly what you just said. It does allow you to kind of reach out and chat with people. It does allow people to get a very real sense of who you are, mm-hmm. both good and bad. But at your level, I think it is very important that you are accessible and available to people. And I'll see online entrepreneurs who are fairly big names. I follow a lot of people around, kind of watch what they're doing. And there are some of them that, honestly, my opinion of them has changed after watching how they handle Facebook and how they will not respond to comments or suggestions. Like, they're just too good or too busy. It's an unfortunate thing, but after a while I think, well, if you're that snotty, I don't want to deal with you, and I go somewhere else.
Well, I know, and you're right. If you ever want to check out the value of someone's opinion, just get to know them a little bit. And I think what Facebook does is let people get to know you in a way that a lot of people probably shouldn't participate because we get to know them, we don't think so much of them. Believe me, at my level, the people I hang around with and the speakers and authors I know, if you ever want to have your opinions deflated, just get to know somebody. One of the things I think at least, bare minimum, I bring to the table is I am just as obnoxious in person, and yet I try to be just as human and nice and just a regular guy. I truly am a regular guy, and hopefully that comes across in person. My opinions don't change face-to-face as they do in my books, as they do in the way I run my business or on Facebook. I try to keep it authentic because I've discovered that mostly people will pay a premium for authenticity because there just isn't much of it around. So I try to be authentic, and that's number one in everything that we do and say and publish and record and go on television and talk about. It's authentic at least.
Right. Now, I know you beyond the story of having somebody steal your identity on Facebook, I know that you had somebody take your Facebook page down, which that's bad. What happened there?
I had a trusted employee who had set the page up for me, and once I discovered on Facebook, if whoever sets it up, they own the page. Just because they set it up.
Really? Even if they log in under your login?
Didn't log in under my login. He
set
it up.
There you go.
Yeah, he set it up my page, but
okay.
He set it up under his stuff. And after...
Because we set them up all the time, but we log in under the client's name.
Yeah, well, we didn't do this. This was back at the beginning when Facebook was just coming out. We didn't understand all the rules. He set it up, and when he and I left, instead of giving it to me and starting over, just took it down. So I lost 8,000 fans in, 10 seconds. And Facebook wouldn't give it back to me.
No, I bet that made your eyes water.
It proved to me that one of those things about lessons again. I had a friend many, many years ago, a speaker I really admired named Joe Charbonneau, who said, of all the people who will never leave you, you are the only one. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of that lesson, that trust, regardless of how much you feel you can trust what someone will do in the best of circumstances and in the worst of circumstances, you better hold your cards pretty close to your chest. And people always wonder why rich people and celebrities and big CEOs and all that don't trust, and why they're considered in some ways to be so hard-nosed about things. They've been burned a lot. And so after you've been burned a few times, you become a little less trusting with your stuff. And I play all my stuff pretty close to my chest, always did. I don't let a lot of people in close to my business or on what's going on even in my personal life. If I want you to know, I'll put it out there and write a blog about it or put it in a book. Mm-hmm. But I got burned on this thing, and I've just learned a valuable lesson. And it can happen to anybody, so just be careful with this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about your website. I'm a web developer, and I'm constantly trolling the Internet for interesting websites or different ideas or, you know, just to kind of go visit, see what's going on. And your website is so colorful, and it's so unique, and it's very much you. In fact, I have to share a story with you. I was on the phone last night with one of my clients who is Todd Durkin. I don't know if you know who Todd Durkin is, but he trains he trains a lot of elite athletes. He has a facility in San Diego. But he works with people like Drew Brees and LaDainian Tomlinson, and he's got a big thing going on today too. And we're building another website for him, and it was so funny. Because I said, okay, Todd, I need to know, are there any websites that you like the looks of so I can go take a look at them, say, no, this will work, and this one, absolutely not. He mentioned Jack Kemp. Now, these cannot be so dissimilar, I don't even know how he did it. He went from Jack Canfield to Larry Winget. And I said, did you have coffee today? What's going on in your mind? He said, well, a friend of mine sent Larry Winget's site, and he said, I loved it. I don't think it's for me. You know, but he said, man, it sure suits him. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Well, I appreciate that. And the reason, you said it's colorful and unique. Well, so yeah. Am I. I am colorful and unique. My wife hates my site.
I love
my
it.
My manager hates my site. I get people go out of their way to tell me how much they hate my website simply because it's truly a one of a kind. It doesn't look like anybody else's website. And that's kind of the goal.
From a web developer standpoint, I look at that thing and go, whoa. But I know who you are, and I read your work, and then I go, whoa, again, because it's so perfect for you.
Yeah, it's busy, and it's interactive, and there's too much going on, and there are too many colors, and it's too bright, and people just, and a lot of web developers say, we would love to overhaul your website. Believe me, we get a lot of this. We'd love to overhaul your website to make it look more professional. And I'm quick to write them back and say, first of all, why would you tell me I'm unprofessional as a way to get your foot in the door, which is what they've done to make your website look professional, because the assumption is it doesn't look professional now. It's the perfect professional website for somebody who is who I am. It won't work for anybody else. I've spent 20 years in the business with people trying to copy what I do, thinking they can take the style, the edge, the confrontational aspect of what I do and make it work for them, and it doesn't, because it goes back to what I said a minute ago, it's not authentic. My website is authentic in that it does reflect exactly who I am.
Right. And anybody who follows you around on Facebook sees those boot pictures.
I do a boot of the week.
They do. And when they see those boots and they see the website, it's like, aha, it's all perfect. It works. As a web developer, I wouldn't suggest that you do anything different, because that website is so indicative and reflective of who you are. It's a perfect match. And whoever built that for you, brilliant job.
Well, I appreciate that. It's the only website he ever built.
Really?
Yep, only one. He's not a web developer. He's a guy who, when I was self-publishing books, did book covers for me. He's been with me 20 years. I can give him a line, and 20 minutes later, he'll send me back and say, what do you think? And he just gets me. He knows who I am. And he contacted me one day and said, Larry, I think I could build you a website. I'm not going to do this for a living, but I'd like to try, and I know your material as well as you know your material, and I know who you are and what you like. What do you think? And he did a great job, and I've loved it, and he continues to do all my stuff for me.
Well, for somebody in your position where your personality is your brand, you have to have something like that. If you were to have a nice blue and white and a lot of white space area, you know, follow all of the rules for web development, I just don't think you'd have that, I don't know, return visitors might be few and far between.
I think so, too. And a lot of people have written just what you said. You need more blue, more white,
and more
blank
space. I know the rules.
I got one this week from a guy who said, you've broken every rule. And I said, and yet look at how many followers I have as compared to how many you have. So I like breaking the rules. I've done it in every aspect of my career and business, and I will continue. So I appreciate your feedback on the website. I like it. I really don't care. And I think it's that whole don't care that kind of makes it work for me. I don't care what anybody else thinks. As long as I like it, I figure there are enough people out there like me, and that's what I want, is I like followers like that, and then I like rabid enemies too, because you can't have rabid fans without the haters. And so I like having something that draws a very distinct line in the sand that says people who are with me will stand over here, people who hate me are over there, and as long as you've drawn that line in the sand, you can create enough controversy to make yourself very marketable.
Right. Well, here's the beauty of that website, and anybody who knows anything about web development and social media knows that that website has to be indicative of who you are. If you're quiet, kind of soft-spoken personality, and you're trying to reach quiet, soft-spoken people, you want the blues and the grays and, you know, a lot of white space. Your site, the first time I looked at that, I kind of reared back and started laughing, because what I got from that site, my immediate visceral reaction was sheer exuberance. That's just
a
fun site.
That.
It's loud, it's corny sometimes, and I love it. So,
thanks.
Would I be able to build it? I don't know, because I know the rules. But I really enjoy that website. So,
thanks.
Let's talk. You're welcome. It's anybody who's listening to us now or in the future, go to LarryWingett.com. It's a great website, and everything you need to know is there. The books are there. You know, everything is there.
All my television appearances, tons of free stuff. I give away a lot of stuff, a lot of video on there about how you can look like Larry Wingett and clips from the television shows. It is fun.
Let's talk about your television show really quickly, The Big Spender Show. That, I'm telling you, it really did change how my husband and I manage our budget, because it used to be before we started watching that show, and I'll tell you straight out, I don't watch a bunch of TV. I think most of it's garbage. I just don't watch much of it. But somehow or another, we stumbled across that, and this was back when we had TiVo, before we have whatever it is we have now. And we would TiVo that thing and then watch it every Saturday morning while we ate our breakfast. And, you know, at that time I handled my money. My husband handled his money. And, you know, we knew what we were each doing, but, you know, we didn't really overspend. We were okay, but I don't enjoy handling any of that. It's not something I'm really good at. He is. You know, my husband's a software engineer. He has charts. He has pie charts. He has graphs. He has, you know, Microsoft money. He gets in there and he just goes for it. So we watched your show, for whatever time. Was it on for a year or something like that? How long was that show on?
2 years, yeah.
2 years. So we watched all of them. And he never did say, well, you know, I think we ought to, you know, maybe have just one of us handle the household. He was smarter than that. And about a year after your show went off, I just had it. And I said, I went to him one day and said, you know, how would you feel about handling all of the money? I thought he was going to go straight up into the ceiling fan. He was so happy. So he has been doing it. I hand over, you know, several thousand dollars every month. He pays the bills. He takes care of the investments. He handles, you know, the savings. Then I get a pie chart at the end of the month. It's great.
I get those too from my wife. They drive me crazy. Yeah. That's not my style either. But
I just tell him, how much do we have? And he'll say, okay, good. You want some dinner now? That's all I need to know.
But it really did
take that show for me to say, I can't stand doing this. I don't enjoy it. I'm turning it. And for me to turn something over, you have to understand my personality. That's difficult for me to do. So, you know, that was really a leap of faith and an act of trust for me to do that.
Well, the people who were helped on Big Spender were not the people I helped in the show. Most of them actually didn't change.
I kind of wondered.
Because sometimes things are so broken that you really can't fix it. And
well, it
by the time you're
like some were heading for divorce.
And actually, that never made it to air. On several of the shows, I said, you know, this is not a financial show. You guys need to just stop this.
Yeah.
And about a third of them, I think, did divorce after the show, which was a good thing. These people never should have been together to begin with. They had different values, and they were never going to be on the same page. And I think that was the lesson of what you just talked about, is finally you get on the same page. So what the show really did was not help the people I had on the show every week, but it sure helped a lot of other people say, you know, it's kind of like the Jerry Springer effect. You can say, boy, my life is screwed up, but it's not that screwed up. And that's what it taught a lot of people, and it gave them some ideas and some principles, and it started a level of conversation and communication about money that they hadn't had in the past, because people would watch it and say, we're not that bad, but, you know, we could improve right here. And then they would start to talk about those things, and that's when people really started to change. Not the people on the show, but the people who watch the show. So you're a prime example of you watched it, got an idea, started to talk, found common ground, and moved to a happier place.
Right. Well, and it really did help us, because it took a while for it to sink in. And you know, it took me a while to really even attribute it to you, because my husband asked me one day, probably 6 months after he took over the entire budget, and we do live on a budget, as most people should, and he said, well, where did this come from? And I said, I think Larry Winkett. He said, oh, cool. that was the end of that. You know, I had never really thought of it, but for just some reason, I, you know, went back to the big spender and you saying it's your own damn fault, which is my favorite phrase of all time. And, you know, it just kind of went from there. So my husband thanks you, and I thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it really does prove the simplicity, and that's what I try to emphasize in everything that I do. It's really pretty simple. If people would just follow a handful of ideas, for instance, I can give you three keys to be successful in any area of your life, from Facebook to your money to your kids. Figure out how you want your life to be, really. That's all you have to do. Get out a sheet of paper and figure out how you want your life to be, financially, emotionally, from a health standpoint, in your relationships. You figure it out. And then figure out where you are. Take a real assessment of where you are. Write all of that down. And then look at the difference between where you are and where you want to be, and figure out what you're going to give up to get there. You know, we tell people that success is about getting more of this and getting more of that. That's a dumb way to approach success. Success is not about getting, it's about giving up. And so you don't get healthy. You give up the things that are making you unhealthy. You don't get better relationships. You give up the things that are creating bad relationships. You don't get rich. You give up the things that are making you broke. And so I ask people to, one, figure out where you want to be, figure out where you are, and then figure out what you're going to give up. And if people just did that with a pen and paper in their hands, their lives would change today.
Well, I know one of the things that I'm seeing an awful lot of is obesity. It seems to me like everybody, I see little kids, and I just go, oh, man, what in the world happened to you?
Well, you know, statistically, we're raising for the first time in history a whole generation of children who are not going to outlive their parents. That's what's going to happen. And that's a shame. And by the way, that's the parents' fault. And I get it all the time. No, it's not. And believe me, yes, it is. We are killing our kids one French fry at a time. And parents use French fries as pacifiers. And we've all seen them do it. Stick a French fry in his mouth. They carry around a little bag of French fries and put it in the front of the stroller. And that's what the kid sucks on all day long. And
it just makes
me sick.
Worse than that.
Killing our kids.
You're right. I live in the Deep South, and I don't see this real often, but it does happen. You'll see these kids in strollers. I mean, infants in strollers, and they're drinking what their parents call sugar water.
Yep.
It's Kool-Aid, but I mean, they're giving them Kool-Aid or just plain old sugar water because they're infants. They don't even have their first teeth yet, and they're giving them sugar water in a bottle. I just want to take the kid away and go wash, you know, wash the sticky stuff off its little face. It just drives me nuts.
It's just horrible, the things we're doing. And we think we're being good parents. And that's why I told you, I'm harder on that than I am probably anything. Don't tell me how much you love your kid when you're overfeeding them, overindulging them, undereducating them, underdisciplining them, and you don't talk to them. So, you know, make sure that whatever you say, especially parenting, you can back up with your actions.
Well, what do you say about kids? The educational system, you know, more and more money is being poured into it. The unions, we won't even go down the road about unions because I might say something ugly. I will say something ugly. But, you know, I'm seeing children who, honest to goodness, cannot, they should not be allowed out of school because they haven't learned a darn thing, or they should be taken out of school and homeschooled. What's going on in our educational system? Because I'm seeing some dunces come out. Dunces, I'm telling you.
Oh,
believe
me,
they shouldn't have a driver's
license. I just talked about that last week on Fox News. You know, statistically, most kids can just barely read their high school diploma when they get out of high school. And they can't count change. They can't type except with their thumbs, and they can't spell then. We are raising a generation of just incredibly stupid kids. Now, when I say that, and I've said it many times, people attack me and say, yeah, but don't you know this? There are a lot of great kids. Okay, I get and I'm not downplaying the fact that there are great kids, but there are just a lot of – most kids just aren't very smart these days. The United States – ranks like 27 out of 29 in math skills, and 24 out of 29 in verbal skills. I mean, we're just not doing a good job. I think there are many factors. I think, believe me, what you said is true. Unions play a big part in that, and tenured teachers play a big part in that. I got outspoken recently on Facebook about that, saying that, you know, if a coach loses every game, he gets fired. If a salesperson is hired to make sales and they never make a sale, they get fired. But if a teacher turns out kids who can't spell or find their state on a map, they're safe. And what do? We reward them with 35 more kids next semester.
Mm-hmm.
And
it doesn't make sense at all. I mean, where's the
common?
This is a big thing, and I know you've got some real thoughts on this. My concern about America and the world in general is the death of common sense.
Yeah.
What's going on? Where is common sense? What
common
overrode
sense,
it? What
just like common sense? Knowledge and common courtesy have gone
I
away.
Yeah.
And I am known sort of the common sense. I saw a blog that was posted this week. Because, you know, I'm on Google Alerts, finding out what people are saying, and somebody posted a blog, and the name of their blog was, Does Larry Wingate Have Too Much Common Sense for America? And it showed little clips from all of my videos. And I'm thinking maybe that's true. Maybe I just have too much common sense. Because people bring me ideas, and I'm doing, you know, Fox Business Today, and they've sent me the list of topics, and I'm just going, these are dumb conversations. This shouldn't be about laws, and it shouldn't be about technicalities, and it shouldn't be about television coverage. This is just, it's a dumb idea. Why don't we just all come together and say, this is a dumb idea, we're not going to do it just because it doesn't make any sense to do it. Common sense is pretty much on its way out.
Well, I know you live in Arizona, and speaking of common sense, I'd love to hear what you think about what's going on there. go ahead. Go for it. I can
well, you
it
talk
out.
About what's happening in the school system, and our poor teachers here, they're guilty of everything that teachers are guilty of everywhere, but our teachers spend most of the time trying to figure out how to communicate with the bulk of their class in a language they don't speak, and the kids end up going home not knowing anything because people in the class can't communicate. I think that's a shame. I'm in a little different position than I have a son who is a cop on the streets of Phoenix and has seen his friends and fellow officers fall at the hand of illegal immigrants. And I see the crime that goes on in my city. I also, on the other side, have another son who's married to a Mexican girl whom we love. And they're trying to make it out that we don't like brown people or that we don't – like Mexican people. I can assure you, the people of Arizona, that is just not true. We love the Mexican culture. We love the Mexican people we deal with. This is not about brown, and it's not about Mexican. It's not about immigration, even. It's about a simple word that keeps getting lost, and it's called illegal.
Illegal, yep.
It's all about illegal. And I love the people. I employ several Mexican workers to work with me and for me and to do things. And like I said, I have many in-laws now that are Mexicans that came here legally and took every step, as long as it took, to make sure that they were in our country legally and doing the right thing. Our only issue in the state of Arizona is illegal. That's it. That's the only issue.
Oh, it's all across the United States now. I mean, illegal immigration is impacting the entire country.
But we've made it about immigration.
But
it's not about immigration.
No.
It's about being illegal.
Right. And I agree with you. I watch so much of what's going on, and I just went, oh, my gosh. And then John McCain, well, we won't go down that road either. That's a whole nother talk.
The guy who was for it before he was against it?
Yeah, several times. He's got to be dizzy. I mean, he has to be just, you know, out of breath from going back across that darn aisle. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll see what happens. Is there anything we missed here? I know we wanted to talk about your book. Is there anything that I omitted asking you, because we took off on a little bit of a journey there? But
I don't mind the tangents. No, I would just ask people if they want to find out everything that backs up what we've talked about here today, do visit the website at LarryWingate.com. Do go to the Larry Wingate fan page on Facebook, and they'll sort of see the interaction that I do and the controversial things that I say to get people fired up and have real discussions. I think some of the discussions on there you commented are very serious, back and forth. I love argument. I won't tolerate disrespect, but I appreciate confrontation and argument. So, and then if they're interested in turning their lives around or their finances or their businesses or maybe their parenting skills, buy a book.
And that you can find your books everywhere, on your website, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
Everywhere.
Find those books, yeah. So I strongly suggest to anybody who's listening to us today or, you know, in the future, this show will wind up in iTunes and it will be available on Blog Talk Radio. Get the books. I'm telling you, they do make you sit up and go, And then after you've had time to assimilate that, after a while your subconscious kind of takes over and you start thinking, well, maybe I could do that. Maybe I should do that. You know, darn it, I will do that. So it does make sense to buy these books.
Well, I appreciate that. So, no, I think we've covered it all, and I appreciate it.
Well, I just really enjoyed having you. In fact, honestly, I could keep on chatting, but I know you've got to go do Fox, which is far more important than my show, only to them.
Between that, I have a Maxim magazine interview I'm about to start.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you, Larry, so much for being with me here today. And if you ever want to come back on my show, call me. I would love to have you back.
I appreciate it. Thanks again.
Oh, you're very welcome. Well, listen, I have thoroughly enjoyed your company and your wisdom and your wit, and I know our audiences, they've enjoyed it as much as I have. I'm getting emails going, oh, my gosh. Well, I'll share some emails with you later. So thank you again so much. And everybody, thank you all for being here. The show will be available for download in about an hour. And, again, you can find it in iTunes. And this is Denise Griffiths and the fabulous Larry Wingate wishing you a wonderful weekend. And I will see you all next week. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.